Well, folks, I don't know about you, but we've been told repeatedly that we are under ceasefire conditions in the Middle East. And as I look back in the previous 5 days and see who is shooting what at whom, I'm beginning to wonder whether or not we're just not paying attention. And here to talk to us about it is Aaron David Miller, former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator in both Republican and Democratic administrations. He's the senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here with you.
Aaron, I'm not sure what we're in, but there's a lot of firepower going back and forth across the boundaries of these countries.
No, there is. You got two events here. You got the Israeli-Hezbollah conflict, which President Trump has at least temporarily put back in the box, although I suspect you're going to see a wash, rinse, and repeat cycle if we can't make progress in the other big conflict, which is the main event. And that is the war that the president launched on February 28th. You have a ceasefire on April 7th/8th. There's been some interruptions of those ceasefire, but nothing like a return to the major war. So the question becomes whether the Lebanon problem is going to explode, which will then sort of morph over to the other conflict and will push the Iranians and the Americans back into conflict. And the question there becomes, can you reach an agreement between Iran on one hand and the Trump administration on the other? And we're now in the fourth month of this war. Ceasefires are made to be broken. I'm frankly surprised that the Iranian-U.S. conflict hasn't gone back to a much more intense confrontation. So there's some hope, but the gaps on the big issues, right, are really, you know, Grand Canyon-like in their size. President wants the Straits of Hormuz open. The Iranians can close them anytime they want. The Iranians want the naval blockade that Trump administration imposed eased. So there is a deal there. It's just it's very difficult to get to because there's less than zero trust and confidence between Washington and this brutal, repressive, authoritarian regime in Tehran.
You have been in the role of negotiator, right? I mean, so what does it say to you? What does it forecast to you with the overt aggressiveness that the Iranians have in salvaging or saving Hezbollah? We know that it's been nothing but a proxy for them, a terrorist proxy for them that, you know, and even in the midst of this ceasefire, Hezbollah has fired over 2,000 rockets into northern Israel.
It's a really good question. It's their billion-dollar proxy, and yeah, it is a proxy. They do control it. You have Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders on the ground in Beirut. The Lebanese wanted to get rid of the Iranian ambassador. He's still there. So Iran exercises firm control, and it is an asset they're not prepared to give up. And unfortunately for the Israelis, their massive campaign, you remember, September 2024, exploding walkie-talkies, exploding pagers, the killing of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. The Israelis believed that they had hollowed it out. But Hezbollah, like Hamas, Gaza, they face somewhat of a similar problem, although Hamas's capacity to strike Israel is not nearly as lethal as Hezbollah's. You can't get rid of these non-state actors through military means alone. The Brits ran into this problem in Northern Ireland. The only way to do it was somehow to incorporate the IRA and the Protestant paramilitaries in some sort of political solution. But nobody's talking about basically including Hezbollah as part of some sort of peace settlement. So, no, this is I'm a rock and roll fan. This is Hotel California and the Eagles. You can check out any time you want, but you can never leave. And that's the real problem, I think, for Americans, the administration. I work for Republicans and Democrats. I voted for Republicans and Democrats. More often than not, the Middle East is a place where U.S. ideas on peacemaking and war making go to die. It's not a happy place. And we got to be very, very careful. Iraq, Afghanistan's a cautionary tale, as is this war launched on February 28th. Is an example of when a great power ends up wrestling with smaller ones whose stakes are existential. That means Hezbollah, it's about Hezbollah's existence, Iran's about Iran's existence, and Israel. It's about Israel's existence, too. When the stakes are existential, the great powers, no matter how great they think they are, they don't have a greater stake in doing, surviving, manipulating, maneuvering than the folks who live in the neighborhood. And we forget that in this region, and we can't.
It seems as though the ebb and flow of diplomatic relations here have been very tenuous. And I was reading a comment that President Trump made to the Financial Times the other day in terms of Benjamin Netanyahu. And he says, I call all the shots. He doesn't call the shots. I find this kind of rhetoric now that's going on. There's something, there's an underbelly to what's happening in our relationship with Israel right now, where, you know, Netanyahu even came out the other day and said, yeah, I support that we stop getting arms from you guys. I mean, we have to do it in phases, but I'm in complete support of that. And yeah. I think everybody is trying to telegraph to the other one, we're going to do what we need to do for our salvation, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an accurate analysis, Newell. It just that President Trump has enormous leverage over Benjamin Netanyahu.
Oh, of course.
And it really has nothing to do with the conflict. It has to do with the fact that this prime minister, the longest governing prime minister in the history of the state of Israel, has governed the country 15 of the last 17 years. Is on trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in the Jerusalem District Court 3 years and running. Netanyahu must remain in power, and Donald Trump is more popular in Israel than he is. And elections are coming October. They have to be held by October 27th. Netanyahu needs Donald Trump, not as a passive campaigner. Netanyahu needs Trump to set up an election central headquarters in Washington and run a reelect Benjamin Netanyahu campaign. He cannot afford an open break with the president. That's not to say that the president can remote control him, but the president can Bigfoot him. And if the president gets close to actually getting an agreement with the Iranians, and the Iranians say to him, look, we need a real ceasefire in Lebanon, not a phony ceasefire. We need the Israelis to stand down. And Trump persuades himself that this is his way out of the box that he's put himself into. He'll call Netanyahu and he'll say, look, my friend, we've done a lot for you, and I need you to stand down. And under those circumstances, Netanyahu doesn't have much of a choice. He will stand down. But we're not there yet, which gives Netanyahu a fair amount of leverage still with the president. So these are two adept politicians, both who are somehow skilled in the art of the con. And the reality is Trump has a lot more leverage over Netanyahu than vice versa.
So how does this play out? We have midterms coming up at the same time as they have to have an election, which seem, you know, the Iranians look at our midterms as kind of a weak point for the Trump administration, right? And I would assume they probably think it's also a weak point for Netanyahu as well. And
yeah.
I also assume that they're going to try to do everything that they can to exploit these weak points and leverage them. So my question to you is, what does that look like from the Iranian perspective? What would you anticipate that they do to exploit these two weak spots that each of their formidable adversaries have?
Yeah, it's a very good point. They think time's on their side. They're losing $500 million a day because of the naval blockade. 90% of their imports are seaborne. So there's no doubt they're hurting. But I come back to my point. The guys running this country, the guys that control the guns, the money, the oil, and the potential nuclear infrastructure, for these guys, this is not just a foreign policy issue. This is not, they don't have elections. They don't have to worry about that. But this is an existential issue for them. They think time's on their side. They think they have the capacity to escalate. And they're reading Trump right here to a degree when they conclude, you know, this guy really doesn't want to go back to military conflict. And I think that's an accurate assessment. That said, Donald Trump's problem is he's got to figure out a way to spin a win out of this. And right now, there are only two ways to do that. You reopen the straits without paying for it, which is going to be hard to do. Or number two, you get some move by the Iranians that constrains or restrains their nuclear infrastructure. And that's going to require weeks, Newell, if not longer, of negotiations. So I'm telling you, I on this one, you know, I'm not even going to take a flyer and make a prediction here. It's just too uncertain. There are too many moving parts. I just got to say, this is a cautionary tale. If you launch a war of choice that isn't based on an imminent or critical threat, you really need to make sure that you've calibrated the means at your disposal to accomplish the ends that you really want. You got to make sure you don't overestimate your own strengths. And you got to make doubly sure you don't underestimate the strengths of your adversary. And this is a real problem.
You know, what I found interesting, and of course, I don't know 0.1% of what y'all know about all this. But as I just kind of apply common sense principles to a lot of this, if there can be, I have yet to figure out why the Iranians are want to go throw missiles at the Kuwaitis, at UAE, at Bahrain and Qatar, and I'm just like, why are they doing that? Do they believe that those parties are going to end up putting pressure on Trump as well?
Yep, I think that's part of their calculation. Look, I have no brief for this brutal, repressive, authoritarian regime that murders, tortures, and imprisons its own citizens. But the Israelis and the Americans launched this war on February 28th. And the Iranians are no match for the Israeli Defense Forces or the U.S. military. So what did they do? They escalated horizontally, not vertically. They escalated horizontally. They launched a few drones, which told every insurance company that it's laying out money to insure shipping companies that it's no longer safe to passage through the Straits of Hormuz, which is 20% of the world's global daily oil supply. And instead of directing most of their ballistic missile fire at the Israelis, they turned on a target much closer to home. So they've weaponized their geography, and they've been incredibly successful. Because these two cards, their ability to basically make life miserable for the oil producers on one hand, and to essentially block the Straits of Hormuz and to hold the entire international economy hostage, we're not feeling it perhaps as bad as those countries in Asia are feeling it. I mean, gas in California is probably, I don't know what it is in New Orleans. By the way, I had a year and a half at Tulane. It was one of the most memorable experiences of my young life. I love New Orleans. It's phenomenal, phenomenal city, phenomenal people. It was just, sorry for the non sequitur, but I just wanted to get that in. So I really do think that Iran's capitalized on their own weakness to basically turn it around, and they've succeeded. I hate to say it. But they're succeeding. They're suffering as well. They're succeeding.
You know, what's interesting too is everybody, yourself included, saying time. They believe that time is on their side. We know that they keep elongating this thing. I got to imagine we realize that we get weaker as this thing goes along, right? I mean,
the American
public is free falling on this issue right now.
Yep.
I mean, it's
not to mention the fact that every time we launch a Tomahawk missile or a THAAD or a Patriot interceptor, we're talking in the millions. The Iranians are doing this with against the Gulf and the Straits with $20,000 drones, and they're doing it effectively. So I don't know. You know, again, I work for Republicans and Democrats. I voted for Republicans and Democrats. I think when we're looking at this region, we really got to be smart. And I think the president looked at Venezuela and grab and go of Maduro and his wife and the extraordinary performance of the U.S. military in this special operations. And he figured, you know, I'll find an Iranian Delcy Rodriguez that I can cut a deal with. And the Iranians will never be able to close the straits because the U.S. military is just too powerful. But as my colleague at Carnegie, Karim Sejapour, says, Trump didn't find an Iranian Delcy Rodriguez in Tehran. He found an Iranian Kim Jong-un from North Korea. And that's yeah. part of the problem. And now we got to live with this. And it's not pretty. I think it's hard to imagine now how you get a win out of this, a win for America out of this. It really is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be placing conditions on all the players as to, you know, touching. You're either all, I don't know, you're either all in or you're not. And, you know, and trying to find that exit ramp is sometimes that exit ramp is very elusive. I think you would agree.
I would.
It's not right now. It doesn't seem readily apparent. I keep looking for it, but I can't find it.
No, yeah. I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Really enjoyed the conversation, your insight, and thank you for the time. Middle East analyst and negotiator in Republican and Democratic administrations. He's also a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Okunar Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. There's a new narc in town. John Scott, special agent in charge of the DEA New Orleans Field Office Division, joins us. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheriff. Appreciate the opportunity.
Hope you didn't mind me putting it that way, but thought it might be a little interesting intro. So, John, welcome to the city. Hope you enjoy your stay here. You have a very wide and varied resume. You've spent time in a lot of different places. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Sheriff. So I'm originally from Oklahoma, so I feel right at home here in the South. But I grew up in Oklahoma as a military brat, kind of moved around different places. But Oklahoma is where I call home. And I joined the Air Force after a few years of college. And that got me out to North Carolina, where I did about 4.5-5 years in the Air Force, and then transitioned to being a police officer in Charlotte, North Carolina. Kind of applied for DEA and the Charlotte Police Department at the same time. And obviously the PD was much more efficient in their hiring process. And I was able to get picked up pretty quick. With DEA, it took almost 3 years to get on. So while I was waiting for DEA to finally call, I served as a police officer there in Charlotte, North Carolina. Really enjoyed being a local police officer. But once I got that call, I had really wanted to be a DEA agent for several years. I kind of put my sights on DEA. And so when I got that call, I jumped at it and ended up getting assigned to Miami Field Division right after the academy and did my first 5 years in Miami. Great place to learn the job as a DEA agent, exposed to a lot of big cases, international travel. And during those cases and that travel, I knew quickly that if I really wanted to do the job the way that I wanted to do it, I needed to learn Spanish. And so the one good thing about DEA is, well, there's a lot of good things about DEA, but one in particular is our foreign presence. We have almost 90 offices worldwide. And so I put in for the opportunity to go overseas and got selected to go to Mexico, and ended up, VEA sent me to language school, 6 months of language school. And then I ended up in Mexico chasing down drug traffickers across Mexico and Central America. Did that for 3 years, and then promoted to be the country attaché, which is like the lead VEA rep in the country of Guatemala, where I worked out of the embassy there and did that for 3 years. And phenomenal opportunity, getting to work some of the biggest cases that DEA has to offer in both Mexico and Guatemala. And after that, I had the absolute great honor to go back to my home state of Oklahoma as the resident agent in charge of our Tulsa resident office. And that was awesome, not just for me personally, just getting back home closer to family, but also there was great work, great people. Got to do that for a few years, and then DEA has a, if you promote in DEA, you got to go do a headquarters rotation. And I ended up getting selected to do my headquarters tour at one of our out of DC assignments, which was great. But I went and did mine at the border at the El Paso Intelligence Center. Did that for a couple years, working on supporting some of those high level investigations in Mexico and Central America. And then again, I had the great fortune to go back to Oklahoma as the ASAC, or Assistant Special Agent in Charge, in Oklahoma City. So there I was the senior law enforcement officer for DEA in the state of Oklahoma, and did that for 3 years. I absolutely enjoyed, you know, being back in my home state again, but also knew that probably wasn't going to be the end for me. And I had the opportunity to promote into the position of Special Agent in Charge of our Asia Pacific division. And for me, that was a very unique opportunity because I'd spent almost my entire career focused on Latin America. And the Asia Pacific division, I was in charge of, we had 18 offices that covered 34 countries from China all the way down to the, you know, Australia, New Zealand, the Pacific Islands. So very different for me, a huge learning experience, and it exposed me to a whole other side of DEA and how we work with our counterparts overseas on the other side of the world. At the conclusion of that tour, I did about almost 4 years as a SAC out in Asia Pacific. I got tapped to be the Associate Chief of Operations at our headquarters, where I was for about the last 6 months. And then the opportunity, the previous SAC, SAC Hofer, that actually just left and got back home. He moved to his hometown of St. Louis. It opened up the New Orleans Field Division, and I put in, and the rest is history. Super excited to be back in the field where the magic happens.
Well, welcome to this town. And this office, actually, you're in charge of, I think, Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, if my memory serves me correct. Is that right?
That's correct. Almost it's the same amount of offices as I had in the Asia Pacific division, not spread out as far, but still a massive geographical area. Tons of, you know, state, local counterparts in those four states, and a lot of different threats in each state.
Yeah. Well, speaking of threats, and we know that you conduct threat assessments annually all the time. What is the threat assessment here for this four-state region? What are the primary things that we're top of mind that we're concerned about?
So obviously across the South, methamphetamine is still a huge problem. And so methamphetamine investigations, you know, being supplied by violent Mexican, you know, criminal organizations is still a top priority. And we're going to continue to focus on those DTOs, those drug trafficking organizations that have set up cells throughout this four-state area. But in addition to methamphetamine, and even more dangerous and serious issue is the problem of these synthetic opioids. Fentanyl, to be specific, has just been devastating. As you know, you've seen the statistics of the overdose deaths over the past several years. While we're gaining traction in reducing those overdose deaths, it's still a huge problem, and it's still an area where DEA is committed to focusing. You know, we've got several strategic initiatives, such as Fentanyl Free America, which is, you know, our focus on enforcement, education, increased awareness, and just our strategic partnerships within the four-state area to eliminate the fentanyl threat within not just our four-state area, but the entire United States.
When we talk about, and I don't know that the listening audience quite understands the difference, although you know, synthetics is what it's all about, because it doesn't take much, right, to make these types of drugs. And I would assume that on your threat assessment that meth still is probably the number one threat throughout this four-state area. I mean, it's been for a long time.
It has been. Yeah, meth has been kind of king in the South for a long time. And what we're seeing, what's to me, what's super troubling is that we're even seeing some of these synthetic chemicals mixed with methamphetamine. So your traditional drug of choice by a lot of the users in this area. Now we're seeing these drug traffickers mix in some of these synthetic opioids into methamphetamine. So making an already dangerous drug even more deadly.
Yeah. And so when you think about the ease of administration, this is not complex processes in order to make these drugs.
No, it's not. And as you know, like when I touched on the fact that I had been out in the Asia Pacific division, China was one of the biggest threats that we had as far as the precursor chemical threat. The vast majority of precursor chemicals come from China and India. That's the two largest precursor chemical manufacturers in the world. And so we were constantly, while I was out there, focused on disrupting that supply chain, trying to take off chemicals while they were in route to the United States, to try to reduce the availability before it got to Mexico, where these Mexican drug trafficking organizations, they take the precursor chemicals that they get from China and India, and then they synthesize those chemicals in these mom-pop labs in Mexico into fentanyl, whether that be powder, into different types of delivery, but they make it in these labs. There's no quality control in these labs. So testing the potency and all the things that the FDA does for drugs in the United States to make sure that the user is safe, the drug trafficking organizations don't do any of that. So you're right. It's a very risky business because there is no quality control when they're making these illicit substances with these precursor chemicals.
So have we seen a difference in the strategy of what the Mexican cartels are doing as it relates to the manner in which they're handling fentanyl? Because at one point in time when they first started cutting, other drugs with fentanyl, it's almost like they did it intentionally to create a more addictive disorder because of the addictive nature of fentanyl. And in many cases, it was too much. Are they cutting less now, recognizing they're killing their customer base?
I don't necessarily know if that. Now, we have seen a decrease in overdose deaths, but I think that has more to do with our increased presence along the southwest border, more law enforcement.
Yeah, that's huge.
There.
That's huge. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know that we'll ever be able to quantify that, unfortunately, right?
No, that's true. It has had an enormous impact. I suspect that you're going to continue to see, I hope, that the overdose death rates continue to drop as we continue to focus on that southwest border across all law enforcement. But the one thing that's, no matter how much we focus on the enforcement piece, to me, what comes down to is that education piece. Like, parents have got to be having hard conversations with they're not even hard conversations. They're actually easy conversations to have with their kids about the dangers of these drugs. We had the One Pill Can Kill campaign because you had a lot of kids that were taking pills. They were getting pills off the street, buying from dealers. It's like a playing Russian roulette. And so not only are we focused heavily on the southwest border and just focusing in our efforts on these violent criminal organizations that are supplying the drugs, we have to be very intentional about ensuring that our parents, our teachers, our educators, that they're all having conversations with our youth about the dangers of if you didn't get prescribed the drug that you're taking from a doctor and you didn't pick it up from a pharmacy, you have no business putting it in your mouth. So that's the bottom line. And if we continue to do these outreach events and educate our youth, we will see a decrease in these overdose deaths, because that's what it's all about. It's about saving American lives, and we utilize every tool in the toolbox to do that. It's not just enforcement. It's enforcement, outreach, education. It's all important.
Are we seeing any huge differences geographically? I read an interesting article a while back, and I'm trying to remember what publication it was in. It might have been in a police publication somewhere, where they talked about, you know, there are certain areas in the country where you're much more at risk of having, you know, a drug that's been infused with fentanyl too much, quite frankly, because you just talked about there's no quality assurance, quality control, QA, QC, that in some areas of the country, your odds might be better playing Russian roulette than just swallowing these pills that are being distributed.
No, you're right. We do have, you know, we've got a pretty robust network of laboratories that when we seize any kind of drugs, whether that's, you know, methamphetamine and fentanyl, a lot of times it's in pill format. And so these blue M30, like oxycodone pills that are very commonly mixed with and made to look like the real thing, but they're either meth or fentanyl. We always send these seizures off to our laboratories for analysis, and they do often find hot spots where there's an uptick in overdose deaths in a certain area. And we can usually trace that back due to a lot of our investigative techniques and methods that our lab directors and those employees in our labs utilize to try to trace it back and see, okay, this is a problem batch. This is a, you know, very high deadly dosage, and really try to focus our efforts on getting that those drugs off the street in that area because of the uptick in overdose deaths.
We haven't really had, I think, in this four-state area, I think it's safe to say the traditional organized gangs that we think about that you probably saw in Miami, that you probably saw in the Asian Pacific Theater, or, you know, what we have come to recognize, you know, the ones that existed on the West Coast. And with this reduction of violence that we've seen through the Gulf South here for a number of years, are we just not seeing these organizations where they're engaging in these turf wars any longer, or is it just the one-offs that are doing the dealing?
Well, you know, this is just my second week here in New Orleans, so I'm not 100% sure. It's definitely something that I'm going to be diving into. Obviously, you know this better than anybody, of being the sheriff of Jefferson Parish for as long as you were. Like, this is a major trafficking corridor, so a lot of times,
yeah,
you know, you have these gangs that maybe they're not the big organized gangs that you'll find in some of the other larger metropolitan areas, but they do establish these relationships with the Mexican trafficking organizations to help facilitate the movement of dope along I-10 through, you know, from Houston to Atlanta and vice versa, like the money going back. So I'm sure that the gangs that do exist here are still, you know, heavily involved in the drug trade. But it's something that I am going to be diving into and working closely with my other federal law enforcement partners, that, you know, the FBI, ATF, HSI. Like, the one thing that I have seen just from my brief time here is all of the law enforcement community here, it's super close knit. There's not a lot of turf wars between the agencies. Everybody gets along really well. And so I'm super excited about that.
As much as you've been around, I'm sure you've seen that, though.
Oh, yes, sir, I have. And it's unfortunate, right? When you're trying to fight crime,
yeah,
you're trying to fight the criminals, and oftentimes you end up fighting your own folks for, you know, who's got the case, who's doing this. But no, I don't see any of that here. Really good relationships. It's good.
We've been fortunate. We really have never had that here. You know, and I don't know why. I mean, I like you, you know, you talk to your peers around the country and everything else, and they talk about these blood battles going on. I say, for what?
I know. It's like,
there's so much crime out there. We're willing to share it all. Anybody want to share it with us? We'll take all the help we can get. No, that was always my approach. Yeah, absolutely. Final thoughts real quick.
No, so for one, just extremely blessed to be back in the field and to be in a place like the New Orleans Field Division. I really do look forward to trying to make a difference here in the community. That's what it's about, like I said, saving lives, making this place a better place for our kids and for our kids' kids. So thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about what we're doing in DEA, and I look forward to learning more about the threats here, and I look forward to the next conversation where I may be able to dive into some of the things where I wasn't quite as knowledgeable as I will be in the next coming months. So thank you for the opportunity, Sheriff.
Well, John, any time that you have a message to get out, just give us a shout and we'll get you on. Big fan of the DEA. Thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate your time, your insight. And to the men and women of the DEA, thank you for the sacrifices that they make, and stay safe.
I appreciate you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oak and Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. All right, folks, just a reminder, would it be great not to lose power during summer and hurricane season? WWL wants to make that happen for you. We've teamed up with Craig's Electrical and Generator to offer you the chance to win a Generac GP6500 portable generator, a nearly $1,000 value. It's happening now. Go to WWL.com/contest for your chance to win comfort, security, and peace of mind from Craig's Electrical and Generators, because when the power goes off, Craig comes on with WWL. And folks, if you're looking to have a good time this Friday, get ready for summertime football, otherwise known as soccer in this country. Join WWL and the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert and Steve Geller Friday, as they kick around the soccer ball at Caesars New Orleans, as they count down to the largest sporting event on the pitch this summer. Bring your red, white, and blue and meet Bobby and Steve from 4 to 8 at the Caesars Sportsbook. And if you've not been there, you don't know what you're missing, as we kick off the big game between America and Paraguay. This 5,700-square-foot sportsbook with 4 betting windows, 12 self-service betting kiosks. It's a blast. Been there. I've broadcast from there as well. A 147-foot video screen. If you hadn't seen this, you got to see it. And of course, comfortable air condition, comfortable seating, a great bar. There's no more comfortable way to watch the games this summer. Go USA. We got the fever at WWL. We'll be right back, folks.